Welcome to Flogger Presents, the show that provides insights into photographers, models, inventors from the photography field. I'm your host, Andrew Walmsley. Hello. And today, we are on episode 49. I present to you a grand master of photography for all you analog fans. So let's roll the music and find out who we've got waiting. Welcome everybody to Flogger Presents. We are now on episode 49. I do have a very special guest for you. Someone I've been really excited and looking forward to. I have to thank Justin Brookie for the contact here. He's an excellent wet plate collodion guy. I have with me the one, the only Quinn Jacobson.
How you doing, Andrew? Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's great. So, obviously, you're the wet plate master, as we all believe.
Maybe. Some believe, yes, that's true.
Some believe. Yes. We've just been having a little chat, everybody, and we've got a few things we want to discuss. So, I think the best thing with Quinn is let's start with his history. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and what we were just saying about how this has fueled your career?
Sure. Yes, that'd be great. Well, and most people or people that have read my material or visited YouTube or read my blogs, I've done all that stuff over the years, have a little knowledge about my past. But photographically speaking, I really got my start in the military. I joined the U.S. Army. When I was actually signed up when I was 17 years old and went in when I was 18, and I did 3 years as a combat infantryman, and then I had 3 more years to do, and I didn't want to do that anymore, so they allowed me to switch military occupation skills to a combat photographer, and that's where I got my start in photography.
Wow. That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, and then after I got out of the military, I immediately went to undergraduate school, and I did a 4-year degree, a Bachelor of Integrated Studies at Weber State University. It was a 3-major degree, and I did communication, visual art, and photography, and then I minored in Spanish. And then from there on, we had the chat earlier. I talked about photojournalism and documentary work. I worked for years that way, newspapers, magazines. And then I finally ended up going to graduate school in the mid-2000s, and I ended up doing an MFA in historic processes.
Okay. So is that where sort of wet clothing came in for you?
Yes.
Or did you already know about
it? Yeah, a lot of people know this story. I've told it a couple of times before on documentaries or interviews, but it real quickly it went like this. I started losing my relationship with photography in the late 90s. And I could see pixelography, the digital movement coming in. We weren't making prints at the newspaper anymore from the work. We were still processing film and everything. But I could see the writing on the wall. And I just started losing my relationship with the art itself, the craft of it. And I was sitting down. I remember one night I got a nice library of photo books. And I pulled a book out of my library called The 100 Greatest Photographs of All Time, something like that. John Zarkowski of the Museum of Modern Art, the MoMA. And I opened it up, and the first thing on there was a daguerreotype, a calotype, and I came on this little ambrotype, and it just grabbed me. You know, and I'd done my undergraduate degree, so I was very well aware of what wet collodion was. And something just got me, just grabbed me and said, wow, there's your tool. You need that. And I knew what it was about. I'd done some albumen printing in the early 90s in undergraduate school. Didn't make the negatives, but we did the prints and an alternative printing class. So I was really turned on by the whole concept, and that little ambrotype just really got me. So I ended up going to the George Eastman house and spending a week there. And, you know, this is the thing about wet collodion and any of these processes. people teach themselves the process, right? You can get a general outline from someone, but people really, you know, I've got so much blood, sweat, and tears in this work, in this process. it drives me nuts to hear people hang my career on somebody. My career is my career. I made this happen, right? So, so it was a long process. It was 8 months after I returned home before I even had anything that resembled a photograph on a plate. And but after that, it really grabbed me. By the early, in the early 2000s, I think I had a project going called Portraits from Madison Avenue that I showed in 2006. In 2004, early 2000s, I had a collodion symposium with a friend, an albumen printing and wet collodion negatives. So we were doing a lot of things early on, trying to get attention, trying to get people involved. And very few people were involved in that time. And I think that's when I opened the collodion forum up, collodion.com, the forum. Now Facebook is there now, so that's kind of died out. But that started attracting a lot of people. So naturally, after that curve coming into collodion, getting my legs, and then drawing attention, it just kind of overtook me. And then I started doing my personal work with it. It wasn't documentary work. It was work about my heritage. It was work about my metaphysics, my relationship to the world and how I saw the world. So I have a long history in photography. And now I can honestly say collodion has been almost 50% of that time. And so I'm approaching my 20 years going up here now. So it's a long time. It's a lot of work, a lot of, just a lot of experimenting, I've taught a lot of people the process. Teaching will really teach you a lot about the process, believe it or not. And just had great experience with it. So collodion did change my photographic career, put me on a completely different path. I was going to get an MFA, so I taught higher ed for years, and thought I needed to go back and do that some more, and I left that. After that, after collodion came into my life, I just took a complete 180, and I changed my career around and started making my personal work and doing my books and teaching and all that stuff, yeah.
I mean, you was there for, obviously, the start of the digital revolution. You foresaw some of the changes. Was it a depressing thing that you could see coming?
Yeah.
Mechanical things coming out.
Right. Here's what I think. And I mentioned this earlier in our little chat too, and I'll reiterate this. What I saw, what I felt really, that losing that relationship and I was talking about AI and machine learning earlier. If people are present to that today and they're working in photography, they should open their eyes a little wider and take a look. Not too far down the road. It's going to happen real soon, but it's right around the corner. That's what I felt. What I feel today, if I were working in pixelography, I would be looking, and I wanted to stay working in whatever this is going to turn into, I would look down the road a little farther and see if I really want to do that or not. That's what happened to me. I love the darkroom. I love the tactile. I love the object in my hand or the film in my hand or whatever I was doing back in the day. I love that. So that artifact, holding that plate in my hand, really means something. So for me, you know, I just knew that even working in film at the time, this was in the late 90s, early 2000, I just knew at that time digital pixelography was just going to completely wipe out whatever I was doing. And it has. I mean, it really has. I was working as a photojournalist and a documentary photographer. Talk to some of them today. They're writers with iPhones now. They're not even photojournalists, right? So for me, yes, it was both depressing and sad. And I looked down the road and whatever was coming, I just knew I didn't feel like I wanted to be involved in it. And I'm so glad that I didn't. You know, I think it was Chuck Close that said 10 or 15 years ago, he said, photography is one of the most difficult things to, I'm paraphrasing here. He said, photography is one of the most difficult things to, make yourself unique in or establish your kind of style or identity as an artist, right? Because everybody can, quote, do it and everybody's out there. You know, God, now with digital going, I can't imagine what he'd think now. I mean, Look at what happened to stock photography. Look at what happened to photojournalism. Just look around you. And you, if you think that's not going to happen to what you're doing today, I'd rethink that position a little, if I were you, a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. We did a charity shoot beginning of this year, end of last year, and it ended up in the local paper. Nothing special here. It got in the paper without consent from anyone. Pictures out there. Yeah. And they didn't even credit the photographer.
There you go. Perfect. Great example, Andrew. Exactly what I'm talking about. Exactly. That's just a little tiny scratch of the surface, but that's the beginning point of it all. Exactly. Just a complete...
It's just lazy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just such a lazy world. And you see it.
It is.
It's just so wrong. Would you say, though, so like you're saying, if you're looking forward, you know there's going to be more changes.
Yeah.
Would you say you're in a different lane because you're in an analog world, or you don't care because it doesn't affect you?
You know, that's a great question, and I have thought about this a lot. I switched completely at the turn of the century. I got out of the game. I haven't shot a frame of film or any digital since then. Other than document, you know what I mean.
No work. Yeah.
So I completely switched lanes. That's a good metaphor for it. And now I just, I see the, you know, I just see a future that's going to be a lot like what I saw happen with film. And I don't know what it is, but yes, I got out of the lanes completely. It will not affect me. In fact, I've applied this. It will not affect me. And I've applied this to another part of my life. My wife and I, we live in the state of Colorado here in the Western U.S. And we just purchased a few years ago 12 acres of land in the Rocky Mountains.
Wow.
And we are moving off the grid next spring. And we're moving to the mountains. And let's now take that and reverse engineer and lay it back over your question. What lane am I in and what am I seeing in the future that way? Well, that should say something to you, because I don't share the optimism a lot of people share about the future of us as humans. So I apply that in many, many ways in my life, but going into Collodion and getting out of the pixelography game was definitely a deliberate choice. Yes.
That's fair. I mean, Justin said the same, that he doesn't actually miss film at all. So for me, it's quite strange. So we have a lot of hybrid people, like myself. I don't mind shooting a bit of digital, and sometimes I have to do it. Sometimes I just use my phone to document what I'm doing. Sure. But he was like, no, I hate it. I couldn't wait for it to go. And I was like, that's great. It's your own opinion.
Yeah, you know, I want to make something clear here too. As you're saying that, I am not hating on digital or pixelography. What I'm saying, I think there's great uses for it, but what I would question would be the application. I haven't seen it applied in ways that you can apply some of these other processes with, right? So I'm not dogging on digital. I'm not dogging on film. I'm not dogging on.
No.
I've chosen my path and my processes for reasons, and I can give you those reasons. I've given you some of them, but I've chosen my path for reasons that are deliberate and purposeful, and not just going with the tide. Whatever, you know, it's like a boat on the ocean without an anchor. You just drifted wherever the tide goes, you float with it. I don't do that. If I'm going to work and I'm going to do this stuff and create photographs, they're going to have purpose and they're going to have intent and they're going to have context. So I live my life that way. And it's not that I hate digital. It's just, I can't imagine. I'll give you a quick example of this. The work in my book here, the new Chemical Pictures book, the 13th chapter is all the Native American massacre. The biggest site in Colorado and a Beecher Island battle, another one on the Eastern Plains here. And I couldn't imagine trying to make that work in film or digital, right?
Yeah.
I just couldn't do that. Why did I select Collodion? Because it's of the period. collodion was the process of the time. This is the indigenous peoples feared when they saw photographs were the wet collodion images, the negatives and the prints and the ambrotypes and tintypes. They felt like a piece of their being was put on this material. So this is the process that was current and active. And I couldn't imagine doing it in film or digital. But I want to say this too real quick. This inspiration to do this ghost dance work, the Native American massacre sites, wasn't my original idea. I had a mentor in undergraduate school named Drex Brooks, and he published a book in 1995 called Sweet Medicine. And that he covered the sites from Maine to California, Washington State to Arizona. He covered the entire U.S. making silver gelatin negatives and then coming back. And I got to work with him a little bit and work help him in the dark room occasionally. He was doing that work when I was in undergraduate school. And so I was very influenced by that. And but even his work, and if you get the book, and I encourage you to, it's called Sweet Medicine, you can look at those massacre sites. It's all done in silver gelatin and develop out paper, right? Modern silver gelatin prints. And they're beautiful prints in there, but I just couldn't imagine me trying to do that. Just the two sites that I did here in my state, I just needed that material to support the process, the material to support the idea of what I was doing. And it was really important to me to do it in wet collodion, obviously.
Yeah. I can follow that. It's just something that's so different. I'm the same as you. Obviously, I don't have the experience. You found what you want to do. I've gone into film for reasons as well. And for me, it's composition. It really slows me down. I enjoy most of the process. Getting my own dark room last year was fantastic.
Perfect.
And now I want to teach it. So I came up with the idea of just doing a little workshop locally with some friends and that. And trying to get people to shoot film is going to be hard.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a compromise. I'm doing a digital analog thing. So they're going to bring the digital cameras, and I'm going to tell them they've got to use it like an analog.
Ah, there you go. So, yeah.
Yeah, so fully manual. They're going to set their ISO. I'm going to make them format their cards.
Yeah.
So they can only take 24 shots.
There you go. I was going to say, put a roll of film in there. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're going to expose using a meter I've got on my smartphone.
Yeah.
But I'm going to try and make sure they understand that I might let them only do 2 meter shot.
Right.
Meter twice. That's it. The entire hour or 2 hours. I can do it. I'm no one special.
That's awesome. And that's a great basic fundamental thing to be able to do. To understand what these settings do, what ISO does, what aperture does, what the shutter speed does, and then even to use a meter. And that's completely, I don't think that's off bounds at all or out of bounds at all to use a meter and meter a scene and understand where you want to go, how much depth of field you want. That's excellent. I mean, I'm an educator. I love to be able to help people understand difficult things, right? Like I always say, it's like trying to explain to how to tie your shoelaces over the phone to someone that's never tied their shoelaces.
God.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
You know? So these difficult concepts I love to explain. And I think that's a great idea. You have to introduce people to that, make that compromise, put those restrictions on them and make them work within these confines. I often say, I love being confined to wet collodion. I love it. I'm not going to do night photography or sports action photography. I mean, you can. Ironically enough, you can do both of those. But
okay,
with strobes and with time and things like that, you can do both of those. But you know what I'm talking about. All the bulky gear in a dark room, packing it out in the neck. You know, crazy. So I love to be held. I don't like limitless stuff. It gives me anxiety. I love, what are my parameters? You give me 24 frames, you give me my manual settings, you give me my ability to adjust my aperture and shutter speed, and you make me work within those 24 frames. That's a good thing.
Yeah, Yeah, I think so. I think sometimes not having a lot of equipment, lenses, lighting, makes you better. So I only had a 50mm when I started. I still only shoot 50mm
Awesome.
in film.
Yeah, I like your abandoned building stuff too. That's great. I'm into that. I'm into this. Wet collodion is has so many kind of what do we say, these connections, human connections back and forth. Like it's an abandoned process, and I photograph abandoned people. It's a little bit difficult and arduous, and the people that I photograph sometimes are like that. It shows my own human imperfections, all the grit and fingerprints or whatever. I mean, I can make super clean plates and all, but I purposely did some stuff with developer in the skies of these negatives and things, so it just shows you're a human being. How to hold that plate, and I love that. It reflects that own imperfection, that whole balance of. I think what happens when you get into the pixelography world, you end up, and you'll relate with this because you do film, you end up with this perfect world, and we know that we're not perfect, and it creates a dissonance in our head, and so it becomes kind of a fight or a struggle. To say every time I punch this button, that perfect image comes off that printer every single time, and it's just everything's perfect. Every pixel is perfect, and we know that's not life. We know we're not like that, and the world's not like that, and we don't live like that. It's almost like social media. It's kind of a fake front. Everybody's showing their very best. Nobody's showing themselves crying in the corner, depressed and drunk, right? I mean, it's all the best stuff all the time, and that's kind of how the pixelography or digital world works for me. It's a little too perfect. I want to see the human being. Who was it? Charles Baudelaire, the French poet. He said he hated photography, and well, he should have. Coming off the backs of painting, having your portrait painted, which you would have to be incredibly some.
Mega rich.
Yeah. There you go. He was saying photography. It can't be art. It's a mechanical thing. And he said this, he said, in a paraphrase, he said, art must contain a piece of a man's soul. I always took that everything. And I started, after I read that, I started putting my fingerprints on my plates. I used to have sitters put their fingerprint on the top corner and mine down on the bottom corner.
That's beautiful. Do you know what you would like? So them abandoned shots were shot with a documentary photographer I met for the first time. Now he's doing a project about the fishing industry that's more or less gone from this city. It's in the north of the UK. So he's been interviewing him. So he's took these guys to the pub and talked to him. He's got some letters that they wrote home to the wives. He's shot film as well to try and match the era a bit. And he even developed his film using the water from the docks.
There you go. There you go.
It's not going to be perfect. He said it was absolutely disgusting stuff, but
Hey, you know what though? If
I
you're,
was.
like we talked about this earlier, if you're trying to tell a story, if you're trying to convey an idea, how do you compete with all the images out there? How do you compete for an audience?
Yeah, exactly.
How do you do that? Well, tell that story. That's a great story right there, right?
It's fantastic,
Can I tell you something along those same lines, which your friend did there on this massacre site, Sand Creek? I took three large dried sunflowers from the old vegetation, and I crumpled it up and I put it in a metal can and I put it in my barbecue grill and I burned it all up down to charcoal. Then I took that charcoal, or atomic number six carbon, and I mixed it in tissue, carbon tissue, with glycerin and ink, and I did carbon transfers of the images from the land.
Gosh.
See, that kind of, and now I'm just starting to experiment with the oil prints, adding that material in with the oil prints. So parts of the land are in the image itself. So you start,
that's amazing.
You start transcending photography, and I don't care what you want to call. I call myself an artist really more than even a photographer anymore because of all this.
Yes.
But you start transcending photography, right? I'm already out of the silver processes and I'm making carbon or oil prints, and I'm adding this material to the ink, and then that ink ends up on making the image. So that image is of that landscape. There's part of that landscape physically in that image. And it's a beautiful thing. That's how you can tell stories powerfully. If you're thinking, and if you're, you know, if you want to tell stories that way, I do.
I think that's amazing. Yeah.
And we're all storytellers, right, Andrew? I mean, we're humans. We all have stories. A lot of folks just think, oh, my story isn't interesting enough to tell. You'd be surprised.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. They have feeling about it, right? But they don't know how to use words to inform the audience or the people looking at the work to be able to describe. So it's really important to be able to do that, because then you're inviting people into your world to say, hey, I've got this idea, concern, love, hate, whatever it is you're doing, and come on into my world for a minute and see if it resonates with you. And so you need to be able to have those words to support that work and inform people about the intent of it, why it was made, and the context of it, how it was made, and did he use the water from the base? Did he use the land stuff and make the fun? You know, those are important context pieces. What happened on the land, what happened on the fisher, you know, those are important stories to look at the image with. I mean, think about it this way. I don't know about you, but I do not get in my car and just drive aimlessly. I mean, I know maybe some people do. I usually have a plan. I'm going here and then here, and I'll be over here at 10 and then back home, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it may change. I may not go to that place, or I have to go over here later, or over there later, but I have some kind of plan. That's what I encourage young and people just coming into photography, or even established. I've had people asking me these questions who are veterans in photography, saying, what do you mean this storytelling stuff? And, you know, you need a plan. You have to be authentic about what gets you up every morning. What bothers you? What bothers me is I live on Arapaho and Cheyenne land that was taken from them by murdering them. That creates dissonance in my head, right? And if you're an artist, you'll have those feelings. You'll look at the world, your metaphysics, how syllogistic logic, how you fit in. How do you fit into the world, bro? Like, Socratic philosophy, examining yourself, right? How do you fit into the world? And then the things that don't fit, or the things you feel are unjust or wrong or beautiful or funny or sad, you tell stories about. At least that's what I think an artist should do. And my favorite kind of art is socially active art. My kind of art, you know, sounds altruistic, changes the world, or at least changes some views of people in the world and changes their relationship to these ideas and concepts that you're talking about. That's the most wonderful thing that can happen for me.
Yeah, I think it's getting to that point. It's like, say, some people can struggle to know what to do. My photography's gone all over the place, and recently, like, working with a documentary guy, Tobias, I was like, I can see why he's shooting, but I can see the reasons why and what he's doing afterwards.
Super important.
And it's and it's like urging me think. So then pictures I've done is because I want to do a project about desolation.
That's awesome. They look great. They do.
Well, thank you. And it's not just going to be buildings. I want to do, whether it's a car or it's something anyway.
Sure.
Yeah, and pop a bit of history in there.
Absolutely.
And I think it'll change me. I feel like something's changing with my photography. I want to give it meaning at a long.
You know, you sound like me a little while back. Seriously, I wanted so bad. I told you I worked as a photojournalist and documentary photographer. I love documentary work. So my influences were like, you know, Richard Avedon, Nan Golden, Mary Ellen Mark. People like that just really, I just really intrigued by, and there's a whole bunch of others, but, and I was sitting, and this had happened to me often. I think I would be sitting around having a coffee or whatever and thinking about photography and what I wanted to do and what story would be interesting to tell. And at that time, I wasn't really thinking about my own personal, I was thinking the influence was coming from more out there. And I was trying to say, what would the audience, you know, do you think the audience would be interested in seeing a story about this prostitute following her around for 3 days and see what her life is like? And, you know, would that they find that interesting? And I always, you know, lean toward the things that I would be interested in too. But I'd be sitting around and I'd be thinking about my photography and I'd say, God, you know what I'd really, really, really love to do? I'd really love to have an element of documentary work and then blur the lines into fine art, right? So not telling the truth with the big T, but telling it with a little T, my truth, but still having some element of history, some element of documentary. So you're engaged. Oh, it is real. It's not made up. No, it's not made up, but it's my story. Mm-hmm. It's my poetic imagery. It's my take on this piece of history. It's my skin in the game as far as this goes. I'm not trying to tell you the truth. I'm not trying to be objective. I don't think it's really objective, right? But I did. I crossed that line at some point, and that's really what I'm doing now, and I always have done, is I'm making documentary work that's personal, that I have skin in the game, that I can talk about conceptually and tell stories with. That's really what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we don't want to be bound by the truth, quote unquote, right? I mean, don't take that wrong. I don't want people thinking that I'm not telling the truth about indigenous massacre sites or, you know, marginalized communities. What I say that not telling the truth is objective. Like these are two sides and, you know, like a journalist,
Right.
You know, so I'm telling my story through this medium and I chose these materials to give that meaning. And I tell you this story of my take on it and how I'm involved in it. That's really what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fabulous. I know one of the things we've talked about with wet clothing is the beginning of it. And obviously something you've been passionate about is Mr. Archer. So where do we start?
Well, that's first things first in that order. You know, I think you really start with, and our chat earlier was a really good springboard into this. I think you start with recognizing that we're all standing on shoulders of giants, right? Nobody contemporary has done anything. Let's just put that out there, okay? I mean, there's a lot of great people working and doing all that, but in this context, let's just put the egos down for a minute and say, let's look at who we're standing on the shoulders of. And Archer, other great ones, you know, Niepce, Talbot, you know, your British blokes over there, a lot of them really threw in French, Gustave Le Gray, Parker, all these guys really, really are amazing and should be, you know, recognized in that context. But I think Archer did something well and beyond. When he saw Talbot suing everyone for using the Talbot type, the paper negative, and this is just this isn't truth or documented. This is just my own feeling about Archer saw that and said, I don't want to charge people for this stuff. And I'm just going to publish it in The Chemist. And that's what he did in 1851. I've used that very recipe. It works wonderful and made negatives and albumin prints and salt prints from it. And he didn't get a dime. He didn't get a dime off of it, you know? So that's what kind of sets that apart. So right off the bat, we can start with saying, let's just look at what Archer did. In reality, he gave this process to the world. Daguerre sold his to the French government. Talbot was trying to get licensing fees off it. If you looked at it crossways, you'd get feed, right? I mean, so everyone was after money. Nothing wrong with that necessarily. But if you're talking about why do I hold Archer up so high and all this, I think there's something to be said about the character of the man. And I think we leave that behind a little bit sometimes. And that's why I was very honored to put that placard on his stone and on his gravesite and get people at least interested in. So people who walk through Kensal Green Cemetery now can see that it's just not a hidden in grass. But there it is. He invented this process. Google it on your phone right there. You'll find out what that process is. So that I know people have done that. And that just warms my heart. So to have him give that process away, have that process change my life so incredibly dramatically, and then to be able to honor him and give just a tiny bit back and say, world, look at this guy. This man, it was amazing. And he gave the world something incredibly special. In fact, I might even argue you wouldn't be holding your camera in your hand if it wasn't for him in some ways.
Yeah.
Because the wet collodion negative was the springboard for everything, right? All these alternative printing processes, quote unquote, I call them historic processes, alternative what, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but these historic printing processes, all of them, gumby chromate, cyanotype, Van Dyke, you know, brome oil, wet collodion carbon, wet collodion negative, all of them, right? So all these processes kind of spring off of that. It led into the dry plate, then it led into the roll film and blah, 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 led into the digital or the pixelography. So you can trace that history of photography back through. And I would make a case that the wet collodion for 50 or 60 years in the 19th century really established what photography was. It was chemistry, sunlight, and really, really talented, skilled craftsmen documenting their landscapes and their people and doing the hard work. Yeah.
But where was the LCD to tell you what you'd done?
Yeah. Well, LCD would require electricity, and well, they're around at that time.
Yeah. I mean, it would be crazy to show, I think, a digital photographer and say, here you go, work that. Yeah. It'd be a lot of fun.
I'd love to bring him down into my studio and say, well, there's some glass over there you'll need to cut, deburr, and clean and prep up. And there's some albumin and some Q-tip. There's some collodion. There's the dark room right behind me. You know, there's the roll door to go in the dark.
Okay, yeah.
There's the dark room right behind me. Pour a plate. There's the light studio. Let's go. And, yeah, see what they do.
I mean, at least I would have some idea.
Yeah, I have people come down here that's actually familiar with the process, and when they actually see it executed, it just blows their mind, you know, because it's one thing to hear about it or read about it or even maybe see it on a video. It's a whole other thing to be standing there again. That kind of artifact question, right? It's another thing to be able to hold that glass plate in your hand, that portrait of you or whatever you just made a portrait of or whatever it is. It's powerful, and people respond. You know, we're tactile. We're physical human beings. We need that.
Yeah. I think we can reintroduce people to this. So like you say, it was that room prints back in the 80s, 90s. But I mean, I would personally love to try this because I know it would blow people's minds.
Definitely. Yes.
And obviously I talked to Justin about this, and we're saying, you know, that your entry into it does require not just time, but you do need a little bit of money at the beginning just to buy your stuff.
Yeah, I mean, somebody just posted on one of my YouTube videos yesterday, I think it was. They said, wet collodion is really expensive, isn't it? And I posted back on there. I said, well, in comparison to what? Because it's far less expensive than silver gelatin. Far, far less expensive than digital. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's cheaper than film.
And a hard drive and a chip and a this and a that. I mean, no. I mean, here's the thing and I hope you do. And please contact me because I'll help you along anything you need there.
Try
the process. At least try it. And this is what I'd recommend. If you have any listeners out there that say, wow, this process is intriguing. I've seen it before. I looked at it. I find it intriguing. I don't want to commit a whole lot to it, but I'd like to try it. So you can't get to a demo or you don't have somebody around you, which most people don't. I recommend people going on eBay or your local flea market and find you a little brownie box camera. They're two pounds, right? You get them all day long for 3-4 pounds on eBay. Now those have a back in them that old roll film. It was about that big. It's kind of like a 6x9. Mm-hmm. All you do is you take a piece of aluminum here and you cut it 6x9, peel it, pour collodion on it, sensitize it, put it in the back of the brownie camera and go out and make your exposure. Easy as that. Come back in, process it. I could get somebody up and going in collodion There are a couple of chemistry items that you wouldn't be able to buy in such, well, I don't know, maybe you could, but I was just thinking quantity wise, but for a couple $100, easy, $200, 100 pounds, 120 pounds, you could be up and going and making, you know, 2.25 by 3 inch plates or whatever. Use a Holga camera, six centimeter. Anything. Use a 35 millimeter. You can do anything. Just put a plate in the back. It holds down, light, tight, secure. Being able to open the lens and count it off and close it. That's all you need.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't even need a Brownie or a old 35 or anything. Make a pinhole. Use an old oatmeal can. Use a soda. I mean, people get the wrong idea about, oh, that's expensive. Yeah, if you want to do, you know, 40 by 50 centimeter plates with a $25 Darlo lens. Yeah. But
that's equivalent in digital world anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're talking about is, can you, you probably, maybe not though. Can you show me in pixelography or digital stuff? Can you get me a camera, a unit to process it, a place to store it? Be able to print it out, inks for my printer. How much does that cost? The absolute bottom line, bottom of the barrel stuff, right? I mean, come on. There's more than 200 quid at 200
£1,000 for a printer.
Yeah. So,
easy to get a big.
Yeah. So when people ask me about the cost of going into Collodion, you got to compare it to something because you got to qualify the question by what level do you want to come in at? I've got a table over there with 10 19th century brass lenses on it. You could buy a small home with the cost of those things. I mean, so where do you want to go? But, you know, this is going on my second decade working in this stuff. So I've gone through a lot of cameras. I do have a lot of large format cameras. I've got all the junk, but it's the junk doesn't matter if you don't have something to say.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I've got a 5x4 here. I'm barely an experienced using it. It's just not something I've had time or I haven't been able to afford a lot of film for it yet. Yeah. So, but I want to try and keep it. Just
it was? What format did you say it was?
4x5.
Oh, 4x5. Yeah, great. Yeah.
Mm.
Do you normally say 5x4 or do you say 4x5?
Yeah, apparently the English say 5x4.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I never realized it, and it doesn't really matter. Yeah. I'm not really into semantics.
10x8, 5x4. I think the reason behind that is they're taking the larger number to qualify the first dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah. So traditionally in the US and most places in North America anyway, 4x5 and most places in the world really, but 4x5 is a great. I start a workshop tomorrow right here, 4x5. Yep.
So I know from obviously watching your stuff for a while, you've traveled a lot of places, but you lived in Europe as well, didn't you?
I did. 5 years. My wife and daughter and I lived in Germany for 5 years, 2006 to 2011.
Okay, because I remember some of your videos. You even had your family in there, didn't you?
Yes, in the video.
Helping with some of the videos,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. My family, my wife. I dedicated this book to my wife because number one, I couldn't have done it without her. But all these years, all the support my daughter and my wife, both Jeannie and Summer, have given me. No way, I wouldn't have done probably any of this without them. So yes, my family's very important to me. I am kind of a family guy that way for sure.
No, that's nice. Yeah, I'm family first as well, which is why I'm not a wedding photographer.
Yeah,
doing anything else.
Yeah,
I want my weekends. It's nice.
Yes.
Exactly. So for the listeners out there, we just had a little tour of Quinn's sort of. What part of the room is this for you?
This right here.
Yeah,
this is a studio. This is where my teaching table actually. I'm sitting at my teaching table. This is where if you were a student, let me flip this around. If you were a student, you'd be sitting across from me right there.
Right.
But I'll clean all the. I'm doing my negative prints and negatives. So I teach here. Photograph over there at the studio where my lights are set up and everything. I photograph at the north window there that shielded, and then the dark room you saw behind me here. Yep.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
No, that's really good. So Quinn's got some of his pictures. So anyone who's seen Chemical Pictures, there's some of his work stood behind him. There's some great pictures there. It's funny. I bought your book.
Oh, thank you.
Last year, I left my job. I got some money from the staff there, and I checked myself just to your book. That's all,
very nice. I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, that's cool. No, I was just intrigued by it, and then I think a couple months later, I spoke with Justin, and he told me, the same as you have to have passion for this sort of work because it's a long learning process.
It is. It can be very steep, too, for some people. Yeah, it's long and steep sometimes, yes.
Yeah, he said...
The view at the top of the mountain, Andrew, is beautiful. So it's long and steep, it's worth the climb.
It takes you a while to get there.
It's okay, yeah. Beautiful at the top, man. The journey is the best part of it all, really, I think.
Yeah, I do remember some of his advice was about UV light.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how important UV light was, and he said he didn't when he first started.
Yeah, yeah. People don't understand. Collodion works on a very, if you're familiar with the visible light spectrum, and if you were looking at the visible light spectrum on the left side, if you will, if you're looking at it, would be purple and violet at the end of the visible light spectrum. And then at the right side, if you're looking at it, it would be red, 700 nanometers to about 325 nanometers down here. When you pass that and you go out of the visible spectrum on the left side, you enter into UV, pure UV, A, B, C, and then down into gamma, right? Over here, you leave the red at 700 and you move into what? Infrared. Yeah. And on beyond that. So you get collodion at 325 nanometers, or that violet and that UV down there. That's bright, bright white to collodion. That's why blue is white, purple is white. And then you get over here to the yellows and reds, that's dark to collodion. It can't see those. So 325 to about 450 nanometers is the light, maybe 500 is the light.
So
exactly.
You're segmenting.
You probably saw that in my book, though, right? The
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That what collodion sees. You can actually go. I updated the chart just a little bit here. But you can actually go, 325 is the purple end, and then up here is the 700. So complete black out here, complete white there, and then it's a little bit of room in there. Yeah, and it changes, call it, right? Because of that visible spectrum, you know, what do lemons look like photographed?
Yeah.
They're black.
Because the two white and yellow.
Yeah. So lemons are black or very dark. You bring a redhead into the studio, male or female, it doesn't matter. A redhead into the studio and you photograph them. Their hair's, well, mine used to be really black, but their hair's black.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what's coming back. So it's very interesting that light, that visible light spectrum and what portion collodion gets. Again, another limitation that's really neat to be able to work in and understand. And that's what I try to do in my books, and especially in this new one. I even break down how this process works, double replacement, and how these chemicals interact and what they do and how the light affects them. And so I've really tried to give people a deeper understanding of the process from both the chemical and the light perspective, because that's all it is, right? Photograph, writing with light, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
We're taking that light energy, showing it having it hit something that we want. We have framed up on a piece of glass. Those photons hit that light energy. It changes that material and actually begins forming that silver. Because what do you have on this plate? You have silver iodide and silver bromide, both light sensitive halogens. So that light energy hits the plate. So the highlights are affected most, the midtones a little, and the shadows none. You take it in, you pour this iron-based developer on it. That iron is called a reducer. It reduces that silver iodide and silver bromide to the metallic state of silver, just like your jewelry. That's why plates will tarnish. That's why you have to varnish the wet collodion plates because they will tarnish. So I try to teach the people how that, like tomorrow I'll be going all through this. Student will come in, we'll go over the history, the chemistry, and then we'll start breaking down how the process works, and I'll physically and literally show her everything in the positive variant of how the process works and the most common problems you run into. So it's really important to understand how the light works, how the process works, and that's really what I try to emphasize the most. Technically speaking, not conceptually, of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I think that's important because I think digital's lost that, because all you do is take a photo, I'll just adjust the exposure, but you've never understood light in the first place, have you?
There you go. Now we're getting to the heart of the matter right here. Actually having understanding, being authentic about understanding what you're doing. And I got my naysayers out there in the public. I mean, I'm out there, so I'm going to have some of them, but
of course, yeah.
You know, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But what I think a lot of people get upset about with me, and I don't know for sure, but what I think they get upset about is when I push back like this. I push back and say, well, you know, I think it's important that you understand the process. I think you should be able to understand what happens on the plate. Oh, I just want to make art. Well, you're not really making art anyway. You're just struggling your way through. And when you hit that first wall, and you will, and you're clueless of what to do, and nothing works and nothing will work, you're over. You're done. Lights out. No pun intended. Lights out. You're finished. When you know what you're doing and you've made that journey up that steep long climb we were just talking about to get to that view. Now, oh, my plate's foggy. Oh, I got this problem. Oh, I got that. Okay, I know what to do. Fix it. Next plate. Boom. You're on your way. To me, this is about making work. This isn't about the process. I am not a process photographer. I use the process in service of the work, to support the work, not to overtake the work. It's not about that this is wet collodion. There's a portion of it that it is, but it supports the work. It doesn't overtake the work. The work is about the indigenous massacre sites. And these are the supporting materials and elements and processes that I've used around it to support it. And to be able to understand what you're doing, you can take that technical information and extend it out to the conceptual too. But yeah, when people get lost on that journey and they think they're making work that's important, but they don't understand the tools they're using, it's not very powerful to me. Because it tells me they don't know why they've chosen those tools, right?
Yeah.
If they don't understand how that process works, well, then you surely haven't considered how understanding the process and investing that time and understanding to get there, right? Oh, Quinn, are you telling me you have to understand Chinese to write Chinese poetry? Probably would help. Yes, I am.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally with you. I think it's taken me time because I ain't been in this long, but it's been great to learn film. So I've understood EV is important, and that you've only got, say, seven tones realistically when you're doing film. And I think about that when I'm shooting now because I've learned that. And then, like you said about the light spectrum, I've learned about the is it nanometers? It's
nanometers, yes.
Yeah, nanometer. Yep.
That's I realized 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter.
1 billion. Ah, right. Okay, so that's why.
Yeah, nanometer. Yeah,
it's nothing, is it? Yeah. I've learned that does matter to the ability of film.
Yes.
To, you know, absorb the light and sort of thing. So, like you say, X-ray. So a future article, which is due anytime now, I've worked with an X-ray photographer.
Oh.
Sorry, infrared.
Nice.
And it is fabulous work. And he's done all these experiments with it. He's talking about the process, what he uses. And I've said, look, you need to write this. So I'm helping him write it. But it's his work.
That's great.
You know,
but
great
exposure, no pun intended, but great exposure to that, those processes, to see outside of that spectrum that you don't see with your your visible, you know, what we can see visibly. Yeah,
exactly.
Great.
Yeah. It's a beautiful process. The photography is amazing. He's actually a good photographer as well.
Right.
And again, like Victorian photography, yeah. This stuff will die out.
Yeah.
It is old film. You can't buy it anymore. Right. It's old stock.
Yep, there are some terminal processes and types of films out there, definitely, that will never be made again.
Yeah.
And to your point, Andrew, that's what we're doing with Wet Collodion as well, isn't it? We're seeing outside exactly. that visible spectrum. And can I give you a good example of that? Mm. This is what I often show people. Somebody sent me a Polaroid. Oh, Nicholas sent me a Polaroid of Archer's grave site. He was there, but right. he signed it. But let me give you a good example of that. This is a man that I photographed, and his tattoos all disappeared.
Why
is
because
that?
Of the color spectrum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're too dark.
That's right. So when we look at the green and blues in his tattoos, those are like whites.
Yeah, to the wrong side of the spectrum.
And he's Hispanic. He's Latino. So he's got kind of darker skin. So his skin is rich. But he cried when he saw that plate come up in the bath. All of his tattoos were gone. And he was like, wow. He first cried, and then he said, God, I look like a warrior. I look like my grandfather. Yeah. So the idea of using light spectrum to create effect, this newspaper called up and said, hey, can we come over and do a story on you? I said, oh, yeah, you're going to bring
it. Magic.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, and they were blown away. I mean, obviously, look at the thing. They put me in the life section on the top half.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so this was, God, Andrew, this was 2003.
Okay. And I think the simple cameras help in that sense.
Yeah.
In that sense. So, you know, you start with film cameras, totally manual camera. So I'm sure that's medium format I showed you.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
So
what are you shooting medium format wise?
Bronicus. So it's a 6x4 box.
Six four five.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, just your standard. Yeah.
6 centimeters, 4.5. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was just a standard one. It was a very low cost. I think I've had it 2 years. So I bought that within my first year of being a photographer.
Wow. That's awesome. I love 6x4.5. I used to have a 6x4.5 Contax. I just hadn't found collodion yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you never know for me.
No, yeah. I'm telling you, I can watch people at a demo, or I can, if they sign up for a workshop, I already know they're hooked. But you can see the people that are just going to go, oh, I got it. You know, they become obsessed. I mean, it's amazing because it's so different, and it does. It connects you. It gives you a much better sense of who you are in your work and what you're doing, and it makes you pay for it. You fail. You learn to fail. You learn how failure is really important. Most of the things you do are not successful, those limitations again, but you still push it out there, and you still push and push and push, and there's nothing I'd rather do. I mean, I would do, if this went away today, my career in photography would be over.
You'd be a digital photographer, wouldn't you?
The what? Oh, no.
You'd be a digital photographer.
No. Nothing. That's not my tools. I don't use the tool. I have no interest. I don't feel that I have any need for that particular tool on a project.
Yeah.
I feel I have such a large toolbox just in the wet collodion process, and both of those variants and all those pop processes, I could spend 3 lifetimes and never get to all of it.
Yeah. I think for me, this is what's really hard, is people like yourself have introduced me to all this different type of photography, and it's like, oh my God, my mind's blown. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I have the physics of money.
Yeah, dang.
Unfortunately.
Here comes the money and the travel and the time, missing work and doing all that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know what's great, though? And this is what I love about technology. People often ask me, and I write about it in the book, too. They say, oh, how did the wet collodion process get revived? I said, well, there's a lot of ways you can look at this. I always say the web. You know, Tim Berners-Lee, the guy that invented the World Wide Web, that's how the revival happened, because without this, without this technology, very few people would be doing anything, and you wouldn't have this global revival of it. I'll take a little credit for Europe maybe, but overall, come on, let's be honest, it's the web and it's the sharing of information, people trying things, sharing things. And I have found, and I understand your dilemma, money, and I want to do this and I want to do that. Pick, you know, we were talking about, you get in your car and drive aimlessly. That's kind of like I want to try all these processes. I recommend people say, come up first, have a moratorium on making photographs just for a minute, and say, let me think about what it really gets me going, what I really want to talk about, what I'd really want to share and have conversations about if I made work about. Pick that topic, that subject, whatever it is, and start with some process that supports that, or some ideas, aesthetic ideas or whatever that support that, and go to that process or those processes or those combination of process, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what the process is. What matters is it supports that idea. So I always say first things first in that order. Come up, you know, before we can write a book or make a movie or tell a story, we have to have a story. We have to have an idea. We have to have something that really makes us want to be challenged by our ideas. I push back. What do you mean by marginalized communities? What do you mean otherness? What do you mean othering? And yeah, I want to talk about all that. And that's what this kind of work behind me was made to do. Right. I did a whole project about the show, the Holocaust, when I was in Germany, but I did it on Kristallnacht sites that were destroyed on November 9th and 10th, 1938. They went through and all the synagogues in Germany and most of Austria, Night of Broken Glass. So there I am pouring collodion on glass plates, making photographs of these synagogue sites where a great synagogue once stood. And I'm using cyanide, the very chemical they used in the gas chambers that I visited there to murder all those people. So now I'm giving meaning to these materials and I'm bringing them in. See, this is the gift collodion gate has given me over these years. Yeah. It reveals itself to me. It reveals these materials and these connections with these ideas. But first, you have to have the idea. You have to have something that you want to tell a story about and that you're passionate about, right? Non-narrative images, these one-off images of flowers and vases, they're beautiful. They're wonderful. Great. Perfect. But you'll get a lot of likes. You'll get a lot of whatever you're after. That's great. That's fine. But if you want to tell a story, and if you want history to look back on and say, wow, he spent a life well-lived in making work and telling stories about these ideas. I may disagree with some of it, or I may not like all of it, or I may not like any of it, or whatever. But the point is, he had an idea. He was passionate about it. He found the tools he needed to make that thing happen, and he did it. And that's what the advice I give. So, and that's what I tell people about this process. And they may look at, they may open this up and say, oh, look, the negative in the print. Oh, I'll go out and do a negative in a print, right? And it's not that easy. And be very disappointed when you try to jump over what you shouldn't in this process and you try to jump out too far ahead, you'll crash and burn. If you start from the beginning and work through it and do it safely and logically and rationally, not kill yourself or your family or your animals or neighbor, you'll get to a point where you say, wow, I feel like I can go on to the next step. So it's positives in the beginning, making ambrotypes and tintypes, even tintype, and then go to glass. And then you work in that a while. And then you'll eventually grow out of that at some point. You may go larger scale, but you'll still grow out of that. And then you'll go to negatives. And then negatives will obviously lead to printing out processes. Because wet collodion negatives do not work with modern develop out paper. They just, they're too dense. They're too heavy. They need to pop contact print, right? So that's kind of the progression. But I don't discourage anyone from going. I discourage them from jumping from A to R when they need to go to A to B, right? And then B and D and E and F. And jumping can make it difficult. And I've seen people burn out on this because they can't quite get it because they haven't worked in it long enough or understand the process well enough to go. It is a natural building block. And you don't need an instructor every time you turn around. You could take an initial workshop and get going. And to be honest with you, after that, you'll figure it out. You'll figure it out. Like I said earlier, Nobody teaches you this process. You learn this process from experience and failure, but you need some guidance so you don't kill yourself or hurt your family or friends, but you don't need someone hovering over you. I've had numerous, I don't know how many over the years, get my book and videos and say, I learned the process through your book and videos, and here's my work. Perfectly great, fine, beautiful. Never took a workshop. What do workshops do for you, though, if you can take one? A lot of times, if it's from a good, reputable source, a lot of times they will get you into that safe zone. They'll get you where you can confidently make plates, maybe not understand completely everything, but confidently make plates and be safe about doing it. That's what workshops will really do for you.
No, that's good. I think you're right that it's steps, and I like the idea. What you're saying is story first, and supplement it with the right tools. And I think because most of us started in digital, we had the tools first, learned how to work the tools, then made a picture.
There you go. You're spot on. That's exactly on point. And that can get you going down that road of non-narrative and just experimenting. And there's nothing wrong, there's nothing wrong with doing that. I'm poo-pooing that. I'm not. I'm just saying, if you get into making tintypes and you make tintypes for 5 years and you're not saying anything, or 2 years and you're not saying anything or not doing anything, it's time to get off the milk and go onto the meat at some point, right? I mean, you can play an experiment. I did for years. I mean, I had to. I didn't, you know? I mean, so experimenting's great. The problem with experimenting is when you make a great non-narrative image in your experiment and then you post it or you publish it as artwork, it creates noise for everyone else trying to do, you know, narrative work in a way that's more constructed, if you will. You know, that's the problem a lot of times. And there's nothing wrong. And I don't want to come down on people like this, but, you know, Joe or Sally goes out and takes a tintype workshop, makes a beautiful photograph of a vase and a rose. Next thing you know, you see it in popular photography and they're calling it, you know, some art, you know, made in a workshop or done here, you know. And it's like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that at all. What's wrong with it is the way they frame that. They don't say, this is a workshop image from blah, blah, teacher in blah, blah, wherever, right? They don't say that. Mm-hmm. They're passing it off as some, you know, and this is what artists are great at doing, being very, you know, very noncommittal and very vague. And so they publish the image and it's a workshop image of a vase and a flower or some bottles. It's beautiful. It looks great, but they're implying that it's part of a work they're doing and that they're established and can do this when it actually is coming out of a workshop. And the problem with that is then you take a guy like Andrew, like yourself, that's trying to work on a project that's blood, sweat, and tears. And you're trying to figure out how to do this aesthetically. And you're trying to present these images with narrative and with context and intention, and people are automatically just attracted to the non-narrative image because it's beautiful and it's not as involving, and it does create noise for people trying to do work in a larger context. I've seen it. I've experienced it. I was going to show you this. This is what I've done in the book. Now I've actually created examples of mistakes on purpose.
I think that's as important.
Yeah. And put in those mistakes and then talk about the resolution to them. So chapter 8 is all troubleshooting.
Because I know I've started showing sometimes when I make mistakes. So one of the abandoned ones, I tried shooting at 1/60th.
Mm.
And it's too slow.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of movement.
Yeah. I really love movement. If it's right.
Yeah, I mean, so the exposure was maybe one, maybe two stops out.
Yeah.
But it's no big deal. But I don't think you should be scared of doing that as well.
Absolutely. I don't know who said it, but all good photographs aren't sharp, or something like some implication that you can turn like I was talking about clothing, you can turn those imperfections into something interesting. Again, if you have this kind of story going on.
Yeah.
You know, you need a reason. All of those, a shutter speed, depth of field, ISO types of film, types of processes, all of those, to my mind, need to be supported by some kind of story. You need a reason to do that. Mm. You know, you need a, why did you choose that, Quinn? Well, I chose it for this reason, this, whatever it is, right? Why are you using 19th century process? Oh, because these events that I'm talking about were right in the prime of the 19th century. This was a photographic process being used. A lot like your buddy, you know, a lot like your friend there, using the water and me using the plants. And those all have specific reasons, and you can identify that. That's called defending your work. And a lot of people can't defend their work. That's why some people get pissed off at me when I say you need context and intention to the photographs to tell the story. Nobody's going to open a 300-page book up to page 200 and start reading. Start from the beginning. It needs context for the story to build, the characters and all that. We get away with murder as photographers. I mean, that, you know, snapping a photograph of a, you know, pumpkin and putting it up, you know, filtering it and putting, what, you know, it's artificial response. It's not good.
And yeah,
those things aren't real. People are really emotionally responding to that because look, you've just hit a candy center in their brain visually with that. Right. I mean,
yeah,
you're not telling a story with that.
Yeah, it's not on an emotional level either.
Right, so right. There you go.
It won't stay, will it?
There you go. That's it. It's a sweet in your mouth for 10 minutes and it's gone and you've forgotten about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can see what you're saying. You know, I would like that ability for people to remember what I've done or how I've helped them.
Yeah.
Even with podcasting, to me, you know, this is a big lesson in life for me. I never knew I'd end up doing this.
It's great. I love it. I listened to your chat with Justin. That was awesome. I loved it.
Yeah, a lot of respect for you.
No, thank you. Yeah.
You know what?
It's funny. His book just shipped today.
Oh, wicked. I love seeing him out on the street. And I think that's ace. It's like street portraiture, I think.
He is. He's in Soho. They're doing street portraiture. He told me he bought my book the other day and he said, he's excited to get into the pop, the printing out processes. That's what you'll probably see from him next is what we're moving, okay, where he's moving into. You do, and this is another, and it's kind of hard to relate if you don't work in the process, but you do kind of not burn out on positives, the ambrotypes and tintypes. You never really burn out on those. You just feel like you reach a certain level and it's naturally to progress into the 19 or into the negatives and the printing out work is where you really want to go. In the 19th century, you were not called a photographer if you didn't make negatives and prints. You were called an ambrotypist or a tintypist or something like that, you know?
Okay.
It was another level of work. It would be similar to having your portrait made in a really high-end studio versus going out and having the Afghani street camera guy do it for a passport photo or something, you know? Not that extreme, but you get the point is negatives or special. Negatives, you need to know what's going on to be able to expose and develop and print and all that stuff properly.
Yeah.
But the great thing about this book that I have out now or coming out right now as we speak, so I've got 42 brand new high definition videos for a virtual workshop.
Which is awesome. So for anyone listening who's not seen the book, Quinn talks about the whole process from a very simplistic point of view. You know, I was able to understand it, and there's some lovely history there.
Great, thank you.
No, that's cool. And obviously now you've got the special editions. So do you want to tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, this is I just released. This is the, I want to say the, fourth iteration of Chemical Pictures. They started in 2006. And I've published two since then. So this is the fourth iteration, the third or fourth. I don't know. Anyway, Chemical Pictures have been going on for a very long time. And this is my final writing on the technical. So it's 12 chapters of both positive. And when I say positive, I mean ambrotypes, tintypes, and negatives. And negatives include, that's a whole chapter 11, That includes the second part of that is chapter 12, which is pot prints. So I cover albumin printing, chloride printing, salt printing, gelatin chloride printing, and Rollins oil printing. And then I do a quick overview on carbon. This is a limited edition work. I'm only doing 300 copies of this particular book that will actually come from where I'm sitting right here. I sign them, I personalize them. People are spending money on them. They spend time or money with me. I want to try to make it right. So try to make these first 300 special. And so they're all numbered, they're editioned. And in the 13th chapter of this book is the Ghost Dance work, the Ghost Dance Native American Massacre sites in Colorado. They did the two sites, Sand Creek and Beecher Creek, or Beecher Island, sorry, I always say that, Beecher Island. And this will, I have about, I want to say 80 copies left, 80, 85 copies left of this, somewhere in there. And then once those are gone, probably by next month, the Amazon edition of the book will go up, and that will have the only 12 chapters. It won't be signed or anything like that. So if you know me and you know my work, you might want to have something personalized, or you want to see the Ghost Dance work. I haven't published any of that anywhere really. People are interested in, and down the road, these numbered books, I wanted to turn it into a little piece of specialness for people rather than just another technical manual. I wanted to have something special. And to be honest with you, I left all the technical stuff pretty much gray. And so there's not a lot of photographs in there, and it's 230 pages. So there is, it is dense text, and it's text rich. And there is a lot of information in this book, a lot.
No, I think that's cool. So if anyone wants to buy them, is that only on the website?
Yeah, studioq.com, yeah. And just click on that front image and you go right. There's a CONUS and OCONUS within the continental U.S. and outside the continental U.S. And you just click that and it'll take you through to a PayPal link. I'm doing it all through PayPal. I can't manage. This is logistical sign and edition number books and have, you know, 200 orders and have, you know, it's like, it's a lot. And my wife, Jeannie's just, she, if it wasn't for her, I would, boing, I'd be in the nut house right now. We got them all out. We're caught up as of, no, we're not, because I just saw a couple come in, but we were caught up as a couple of hours ago.
Well, let's hope I can have some influence.
Wonderful. Nice. I greatly appreciate it. And again, if you don't, you know, if I'm just a Joe Schmo to you, but you might want the technical stuff, wait until the Amazon release. There'll be 99 US on Amazon, but it won't have the 13th chapter, but you'll still get all 42 HD videos. It's a whole workshop set. There's nothing like it out there. There's nothing like it complete. I even show you how to bake tintypes in chapter 7 and all that stuff. You probably saw that in the other book, but so it's really complete. I've added a lot to it. And really what I'm proud about is the story of Ghost Dance and the Indigenous Massacre site work.
No, that's cool. Let's hope some people get on with that and start buying it.
I appreciate that.
No, that's cool. So we're going to take a different sidestep here. And I'm going to put you through my random questions.
Sweet.
It's payback time.
Yes.
Right, so I'll give you a nice early one, a nice easy one to start with. It's your last day on Earth. What song do you play?
What song do I play? That is a great question. I've been listening lately a lot to Otis Taylor. He's a local artist here in Boulder, Colorado. He came up with a whole brand new genre of music called hypnotic blues. And
hypnotic
blues. And he wrote the song Sand Creek Morning Massacre.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's about the massacre here at Sand Creek that I photographed. So I've been listening to Otis Taylor a lot. I like probably Blue Rain in Africa is a song by Otis Taylor I've listened to.
Okay, well, that's cool. I'll have to check that
out. Yeah, Blue Rain in Africa, Otis Taylor. He tried to take the banjo back as an original African instrument, and I love him for that. He's awesome. Incredibly talented.
That's nice. Question two.
Yes.
You've just entered the afterlife. You get to choose any animal, and they will bond with you for eternity.
Mm. God, that's a great question. They'll bond with you for eternity.
A lot of people go with easy options here.
Yeah, I would say without having any needs in an afterlife, right? All the needs are met. I would go for my cat, Moshi.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a Tonkinese, Siamese, Burmese mix. He's a Tonkinese seal point cat. He's beautiful. And he's such a great pet.
Yeah, cats are cool. I like
Yeah, them. You can see him on my Instagram page if you look over there sometime.
Okay. Yeah, I'll check that out.
Yeah, you'll see him. He looks Siamese. You'll say, oh, there's his cat. He's Siamese. That's Mosh. I'd take Mosh.
Well, the bond with you, don't they?
Yeah, I love the cat. He's like a family
member. Yeah. Well, that's cool. You're looking down on the Earth from your space flight. What part of the world would you photograph?
Without question, the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
Absolutely. These are the most amazing structures. There are places in these mountains that are just completely blow your mind. Absolutely. The Rocky Mountains, Western United States. My favorite place to be in the whole world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice, though.
Yeah. I love it.
I was influenced by a astronaut, and I realized he actually took quite a lot of photography while he was up there on the space station.
Yeah.
And he was just taking pictures of all over. And I think there's a nature book about space. And a lot of his images are in it.
Mm.
Fascinating stuff.
Wow, yeah.
Right. So, you'll definitely like this one. Hollywood are making an autobiography of your life. Who would play you?
Oh, no. I've been told that I sound like Kevin Costner. Is that true?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, okay. There's a bit of Kevin Costner in you.
Kevin Costner. Hi, everybody.
Yeah.
It's Kevin Costner. I was in Dances with Wolves, and now this guy Quinn Jacobson is doing this ghost dance thing. I'm getting him confused.
Google has logged enough data to know your every move. They have invented a new app that calculates the length of your current relationship. Would you enable it?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My wife and I are celebrating our 28th year this year.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so we have one soon-to-be 27-year-old daughter. She'll be 27 in 8 days. And we just have the one daughter, and she's married now, actually. And she's got a good husband. They live here just in East Denver by us. So, yeah, I would have no problem. I don't have any problem with that at all. I love my wife dearly. And I wouldn't know what to do without her, to be honest with you. After 28 years, you know what's interesting, Andrew? We had this book release party. I already told you that. But during that party, we're sitting around chatting. We had it outside. It was very nice and blah, blah, blah. And we're sitting around chatting. And I told Kendrick, my daughter's husband, my son-in-law, basically. I said, Kendrick, you know, Jeannie and I are going, we're going to pass the point this year. He said, what do you mean the point? I said, the point is when you've been married or with someone longer than you'd been alive when you met them. So I just cried. We 28 years.
Okay,
27 when we met. So this year we cross over, and Jeannie's already there. She's just a year and a half older than me. So we're crossing over. So we've been with each other longer than our previous life had existed. So that's where you start getting, you know, you talk in, you know, we and this and that. You never leave. You're never alone. You're never, you know. It's nice. I like it. I love it. It's great. I love being married, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
I'm the same.
I'd hate to be, you imagine dating and the whole weird scene. I couldn't imagine being, no way, no way.
No, and especially as a photographer. Nowadays, I think, what you do.
Yeah. I'd be in a hermit or a drunk in the alley or something. I don't know. I couldn't deal with it, but yeah. Share away, Google. I have nothing to hide.
Right. Does the Tooth Fairy invest her money or leave it in a bank? Because she must need a lot of change for all the kids.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. You know what she does? She actually uses a debit card now. She just puts your pound on your debit card. So there's no carrying around the coins or anything. So, yeah.
Oh, no, right. I better tell my daughter.
Yeah, technology, man, technology. She just does it with an app. She comes by your cell phone, scans your tooth, and leaves you a pound on your app.
Oh, God, I would give up. Jesus, that'd be awful, wouldn't
it? Yeah, technology, God, it's a love-hate relationship, isn't it? I just love technology, and then I hate it sometimes. It's just like, oh, don't go there.
Do you reckon that's an app?
Oh, I'm sure. Yes, I bet you there is, actually, to be honest with you. Now that I'm thinking about it, absolutely there is. Yeah, I would bet anything. Because parents don't have – to be honest with you, most Americans do not carry cash on them now. I mean, right. You know, they – And we were just in, Janie just said today, it's been 5 years. We were in China a few years ago. They invited us over for the Collodion Collective to open that up. That was a lot of fun too. But man, Chinese, it's all just everything. Chinese, you go see that. That's our future. You know, you jaywalk in China. We were in Shanghai and Hangzhou. You jaywalk in China in those cities, they do a snap of you and put your face, they shame you, they put your face and stuff up on a big billboard immediately.
Wow.
There's no cash. It's all, you know, your little packet and scanning with your apps and stuff. Yeah, it's that will give you a little insight into the future of our Western worlds and Europe and America, definitely.
No, that's a good point, Which is a shame.
It is. We're going to lose a lot. We'll gain some, but we'll lose a lot.
Yeah. Okay, your last question, and I know how you're going to answer this, but here we go.
Okay.
There's a bit of film here. So you've been ignored by society. Everyone passes you every day and says nothing. You find some glasses on the floor and put them on, and you discover the world for what it is. Full of messages from God, and there are aliens everywhere. You try to persuade a friend to try them on, but they refuse. Do you keep the glasses on, or are you happy to live a lie and be happy?
Oh, wow. This is the red pill, blue pill.
It is. It's a matrix question.
Do I want to stay in the matrix, or do I want out? You know, that is a very easy question for me to answer. I want out.
And you,
And you know what?
You're too pure person.
Yeah. But you're very intuitive in a weird way, because you didn't know me when we started this interview at all. I don't think much anyway. And you surely didn't know about my exit out of traditional photography. And you didn't know about my exit out of the society next spring, going off the grid. And that's really what I'm doing. Is I want to keep my reality glasses on and let them stay in the matrix, because I don't think they're going to do too well down the road. So yeah, I want reality. I don't want to live a fantasy.
Yeah, there's no wrong with that. So thank you for going through the random questions.
Absolutely.
I appreciate
pleasure.
That.
My pleasure. They're fun. They're funny too. Yeah.
No, thank you. I like to try and think I'm different to a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I got a question for you about your software here. What is this? This is amazing how I just kind of got in. It was there. And
This is what I do for a living. So it's called 3CX.
Okay.
They have it in the state. They have it in America, Russia, Europe.
Okay.
It's pretty big now. Wow. The sponsor, like,
do you have multiple Pepsi. People in here?
Oh, yeah, we could have tons.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
25 people on a free license.
Wow.
Yeah. So as long as you don't make phone calls and just stick to webinars, you can do this all for free.
That's awesome. And I love just right on the front of your website, I just clicked on that and boom, put my name in.
Yeah, I tried to make it easy. The more I've learning how to work it.
Great. That's wonderful. I really appreciate you having me on. And I hope people will enjoy our conversation. I think they will. I think they'll get something out of it.
Yeah. I think, like I say, if we can get people thinking about the process, going to workshops, because there are a few.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even over here, I see a couple of people doing it.
Sure. No. Like I said, a half a dozen books are going to the UK tomorrow.
I've just put on the link there, one of them photos.
Oh, great. There you go. Yeah. Oh, very nice. A nightmare is the horror of poverty. A nightmare is the horror of poverty.
So it is a nightmare to me because it stopped me sleeping at that point in my life.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, I think poverty is violent, yeah? Wow, that's very nice. A great self-portrait too. Love the darkness behind you, and yet that little bit of light creeping through the ridges on the roof, and then that hole there to the right. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah. No, thank you, mate. Ooh. So I think the only last thing to ask you is, I always do like a pay it forward scheme, as you know. Justin recommended yourself.
Yeah.
I love working with different genres of people. Who do you think you'd like to recommend for a future show?
Yeah, my recommendations would be all – I only know what Columbia are. Who would I recommend for that would be interesting and something diverse? You know what? Beautiful. My wife just nailed it. And this will be a wonderful person for you to be on the podcast. His name is John Graybill. I will send you his information. He's a wonderful He's a wonderful guy. He is the great grandson of Edward Sheriff Curtis. He did the North American Indian work. John Graybill is recreating and continuing the work called The Descendants and the Curtis Legacy Foundation. Edward Curtis was a very, very popular American photographer in the late 19th and early 20th century. He has volumes of Native American portraits. The most iconic photographs of American Indians are made by Edward Curtis. I actually have an original polygravure print that John gave me in there. John is doing dry plate, and he's making portraits of descendants of Edward Curtis's sitters. So all the Native Americans that sat for Curtis in the late 19th and early 20th century, John's doing portraits and trying to raise awareness about it too. That's another great thing you could help him with too a little bit, is getting the word out there.
Wicked. Yeah.
I'll send you his info though. He's a great guy. And I know he'd love to sit down with you and chat with you. You'd find him fascinating too.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
he can. I appreciate it.
Yeah, he can tell you all the stories about his great grandpa.
No, that's awesome. So, all I can say is thank you so much.
Well, Quinn. Thank you, Andrew. It was nice meeting you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure. You know, you've got this reputation out there. You know, your books and videos.
Well, I hope it's people.
You scared everybody off now.
Yeah, no. I want to say this. I appreciate that. I would want to say this in closing, that I truly do appreciate all the support over these years. There have been many people that have been right there with me through the whole journey, helping me, supporting me, buying my stuff, coming to my workshops, doing all that stuff. And I want to make sure that they know that I really, truly appreciate that. And I don't take that for granted. I don't. Some people may think I do. I do not take that for granted. Anytime people spend money or time in my world, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, it's wicked. So Remember, anyone listening out there, the book's available. Get it now, and you'll see this special 13th chapter.
Perfect. Yes. Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate it greatly.
I'll put links in the show notes for you anyway. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Send me the link. No problem. Put it everywhere, and we'll get some traffic through there. Let people hear what kind of fool I made of myself.
No, that's great. Well, it's 11 p.m. here, so
well, you I'm get to sign brother. Off.
I've got swimming with my daughters in the morning, so
nice. Yeah, well, you have a good one. It was nice meeting you with you and chatting with you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you. Good night. Have a nice evening.
Cheers, my friend.
Cheers.
Thank you very much for listening to that show, everybody. I do appreciate every minute you spend listening to my horrid voice. It's great that I can keep bringing you these fantastic people, and we learn a little bit more about these people that you don't ordinarily get through social media and maybe videos and things that they give you. So yeah, thanks to everybody for helping out there. There's many more guests to come in the future. One thing I'd like to say is please do leave an iTunes review. This helps the show gain audience, and it helps with the rankings. So I really would appreciate you spending a couple of minutes. All you have to do is open the podcast app on an iDevice, so the iPhone, your iPad or a Mac. Search for Flogger Presents or Flogger Andrew, and you should see the link. Scroll down to where it says reviews, and then you should be able to write one. Please don't hesitate to ever get in contact with me. I'm a very sociable person online. I have time for everybody who puts the time in for me. And if you want to keep up to date with any of my work, please go to flogger.co.uk. So that's PHLOGGER.co.uk. And you'll see all my work, you'll see all my podcast links, and you can even listen to the show through a browser there. I do have a newsletter, and the newsletter shows you all my latest podcasts as well. And of course, there's links to my social media. I do try to be active across my different genres there. So that's me signing out. Thanks for listening. I know sometimes these can be quite lengthy, but I do feel it's very important we have time with our guests. So till the next one.